Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm with a live link at thetrumpet.com. This is the weekend edition. How safe are our smart devices? It's a good question. We've got some answers for you. There's some tips to make your memory better as well. We could all use that. London is just carrying on after a terrorist attack. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And the world's largest artificial sun shines brightly for the first time. Pretty interesting technological advancement there. That and other stories this weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link there at thetrumpet.com as well, so a lot of places to listen, also at the TuneIn app if you want to. If you're really adventurous, you can listen to all of them at once. Make yourself an echo chamber of Trumpet Radio Live. Surround sound.
The only good echo chamber.
You'd have one device on TuneIn, you'd have one on thetrumpet.com, one on kpcg.fm.
Yeah, Trumpet Radio Live stereo edition.
Triple stereo. If that's such a thing. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau. You could do one channel for each of us.
Yeah, that's true.
So we'll have to, maybe we could start broadcasting that way in case somebody has a favorite. Some interesting things going on today. Lots of great stuff here on KPCG. Make sure you check out the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. More on the London terror attack and the rise of Germany as well. They did a program that they wanted to air this weekend over there on the rise of Germany and how that's growing, and it was rejected. London, England, not ready to hear some of that, I guess.
Yeah, I heard about that. That's pretty remarkable because it seems like even though they have a lot of strict regulations over there, they've been pretty much able to produce any program they've wanted to so far.
It's interesting, some of the rules that they have. It's there's a lot of things on television in those areas that aren't good.
Right.
But they're very strict about certain things. So interesting, but you can watch those programs online at thetrumpet.com. So it's always interesting when you run up against, I guess, some type of censorship. So, but the message is still getting out there, and it's an important one, so check that out. And also make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today as well. There's a new Key of David this weekend, The Mystery of Man. It's the series on the Mystery of Ages book that you can get for free at thetrumpet.com. This program deals with the chapter on the mystery of man. The human mind is a mystery to science, education, and religion. There is a spiritual element that sets the mind of man apart from the brain of any animal. And you can watch that program online at thetrumpet.com. The audio will be here on KPCG this weekend. And you can also see it on television locally, depending on where you are. You can check the log for local listings and times there at thetrumpet.com as well. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com. One of the headlines today, the analysis piece, President Trump's unimpressive military budget. Lots happening with the different budgets. He wants to bolster the military. But as you'll see from this write-up, it's not a lot. It's an improvement, but it's been so bad. It's the military's been so gutted, even with a little bit more of a buildup, it's not as impressive as some would hope.
Yeah, it needs a huge explosion of money in the military to make up for depletion of workable technology like aircraft and equipment, and also just make up for years of the sequester and different issues going on there. But the problem is America doesn't have the money to do that without sacrificing everything else, which is impossible. And even with the new healthcare bill trying to go through there, that's going to cost a lot of money that will always take away from the military. So people will have healthcare, but will probably never be able to have military budgets that can actually revamp everything because of just the way that they do the budget. So it's just going to be interesting to see if people are willing to sacrifice their national security for a little bit of free healthcare.
Yeah.
Quote unquote free.
So that you can read that right up. President Trump's unimpressive military budgets at thetrumpet.com. A few related stories to that also listed there. Rebuilding the military, how will America pay for it? and that's the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and Making the Military Great Again. So some good features there, and some good write-ups at thetrumpet.com. Check those out. Here's a headline today from the Washington Post. The CIA may have hacked iPhones and Macs before they even got to the customers, but probably not yours. Probably. So this is interesting because, according to WikiLeaks, they've claimed Thursday that the CIA had found a way to intercept and hack into Apple iPhones just a year after the company's smartphone hit the market. The group also claimed that the CIA was able to infect Mac computers. I'm using a Mac right now. But it's very unlikely that your iPhone or Mac was affected, experts say. I don't know why they would say that, but that's what they're saying. Jeff Pollard, he's a security and risk analyst at Forrester Research, said the most concerning part of this is that it highlights that it doesn't matter how secure you keep a device, you have to understand that there could also be something that gets delivered to you in a device that you purchased. So you're always doing security updates, and we all are, which is good, and you probably should. But what if your device already has something in it that you can't undo? I would imagine a lot of the devices would have something.
Yeah, and they're trying to reassure everyone by saying that it's probably not in our specific devices, but don't they always try to calm down the nerves of the general populace after some breach like this happens?
Yeah.
It doesn't really hold a whole lot of credibility whenever you consider all the times this has happened with different companies.
Well, sure, especially when they say, it's probably not yours.
they're not even guaranteeing
that
it.
That they don't. How do they know which one I have? That's a bad sign right there.
It's definitely some people's. I mean, yeah. That's what they should be saying.
Well, and I just wonder, too, if it's just a matter of whether or not they feel like they want to look at you. You know?
Yeah.
Because if there's something already in the... They can already hack in. There's something already in there. Then it's just a matter of, well, whether we feel like turning it on or not. Right? So, hate to get too conspiratorial, but you do have to wonder. I mean, smart devices, they're connected to all sorts of things. Just the fact that your phone knows where you are, you know, from GPS, or it tells you what the traffic's going to be like on the road you're going to drive on. If it knows that, it probably knows a few other things about me as well.
You have to wonder why apps like Candy Crush would need to know your location at all times. I mean, there are things like that that would pretty much arouse anybody's suspicion.
Yeah. Get rid of that Candy Crush.
Yeah, the Candy Crush conspiracy.
So, well, every app you get, it always says, like, you know, do you want to allow push notifications, or do you want to allow, you know, various things? And I don't know what they're all asking for, but they definitely have some access to your device.
Well, even a couple months ago, because I bought some plane tickets, and on Google, because if you use Gmail or anything, basically, a calendar popped up, and it read all my emails, and everything with a date was put into a calendar. So it pretty much knew if I had like a scheduling or like flights or anything that had like a date on it. It had it all in one calendar for me. I didn't even do anything. I didn't even want it. It just produced it for me.
Right.
So if someone even can just get into your Gmail account, they can see pretty much what you're going to do, what you've purchased, all that stuff, because it all shows up. Like, it's all read by the bot and then produced into the calendar.
And in that case, they'll even know what flight you're on, which is not too reassuring if someone has it out for you.
Yeah, and it's so interesting when we have that sort of invasive procedures on one side of it, and then the other side you have terror attacks occur, and then they look at the person that did it, like in this London case, and they have the whole record of, well, he attacked somebody else earlier, and, well, he was kind of on this list, and yet somehow those people are able to move about and cause trouble. So it's like it's very restrictive in one sense, but in the other sense it's not preventing things. Or I suppose they'd say, well, it's prevented a lot of things we don't know about, and that might be true, but still terrorism is not slowing down, as we're going to talk about later in the show.
Yeah, it's almost like stopping terror isn't even the primary priority of collecting all of this data. If we're not even stopping people who have shown up on multiple watch lists, then why do we even bother to keep on collecting data from millions of people who don't have any criminal history?
Yeah, it's if you've got data out there and it's out on the internet, pretty much anybody can get it if they know enough or they want to. So it's the world we live in.
Yeah.
Can't worry about it too much, but at the same time, I guess you have to use a little bit of wisdom, best you can anyway. And what are you going to live off the grid, I guess? I mean, it's hard to avoid all that.
Well, yeah, everything you need, internet access for, even paying your bills. Most of that's online now, and credit cards and all that stuff. It's pretty much impossible. Some places don't even take cash anymore. You have to pay with a credit card. So, but yeah, even the NSA today, it's the most invasive spy agency and data collection agency in the history of man, the way it is right now. Never mind all the stuff they're going to do or the stuff we're finding out over time about different government agencies. So, I mean, it already does a lot of things we don't know about, or it's not public. So, with little tidbits like this we get in the news sometimes, I'm not surprised if it's 10 times worse than that. We just don't know about it.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So you can read the rest of that if you want to. It's at the Washington Post. The CIA may have hacked iPhones and Macs before they even got to the customers. And, of course, I guess that's interesting because where was that terror attack? Out in San Bernardino a while back?
Yeah.
You remember the guy had the iPhone and they wanted to get into it, and it was a whole thing whether Apple would let them get into his phone to find his stuff. And so that was kind of the issue. Well, you know, you can't get into the iPhones. Well, apparently you can. That's what they're claiming anyway. So no device is probably foolproof in that way. One thing that we probably all want to do better at is have a better memory when it comes to lots of things. You guys were in college not too long ago. You had to memorize lots and lots of stuff. Any tips or tricks that you use? Anything work for you in particular as far as improving your memorization abilities?
One thing I did, especially if I had to memorize like sentences or like groups of text, is it only works if you have time, though. I would just write them out over and over again. And for me, that made it muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And I could also just remember it afterwards better. But otherwise, just probably don't stay up all night trying to memorize. That's the way I learned not to do it, because it just never, it always falls flat the next day.
The cramming at the end didn't work.
Yeah.
What about you, Grant? You got any secrets?
I usually try to use as many of the five senses as possible. It's hard to figure out how to incorporate taste or smell into that, but you feel it by writing it out, like Abraham was talking about, and then obviously by just looking at it a lot you can learn it, and then if you say it out loud you're hearing it and speaking it, and then if you even record it and play it back to yourself you're hearing it as well. So there's a lot of different areas where you can basically bombard your senses into remembering things.
These are some other tips from Dr. Mercola. He has some good info sometimes. Simple brain training techniques can turn you into a memory master. But you got to remember these. That's the trick. They say some mnemonic devices help. Acronyms, such as PUG for pick up grapes. So acronyms do help sometimes for certain things. They say also visualizations. For example, if you've got to go to the dentist, they say imagine a tooth. Maybe I would imagine a drill. Of course, then I wouldn't go. but they say visualizations can help in some ways. Also, rhymes. That's a good one. If you're trying to remember a name or something like that, you rhyme something to remember the name. Or chunking, which they say is breaking up information into smaller chunks, such as organizing numbers into the format of a phone number. So I like rhymes. Rhymes work pretty well for me to remember certain things. But yeah, these things could all work, I suppose. It depends on the way your brain works, I guess. But these are supposed to be some helpful tips to memorization.
A lot of people think songs work pretty well also, because if you think about all the people who could memorize a 5-minute long song and all the lyrics in a matter of hearing it a couple times, but claim to not be able to memorize one paragraph of written text, clearly we can. It's just a matter of how we're letting that information get into our minds.
Yeah, one thing I've said to my kids over the years, and I can say it to myself too. They say they don't remember something that they should remember, and they'll say, "I don't remember." And so I'll always ask them another question about something they're interested in, and they automatically remember it. And I'm like, "Well, how come you can remember that, but you couldn't remember this other thing?" Yeah, you know, because they're interested in one. They cared to remember the one thing, and they didn't care to remember the other thing. So, you know, you see that with sports sometimes, where people are really into sports and they could tell you, you know, the shooting percentage, the batting percentage, you know, blah, 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 on and on, because they care about it and they memorize it. But then say, well, I can't remember this other stuff. A lot of times it's a matter of just interest. If you're interested, a lot of times you will seal it away in that brain somewhere.
Yeah, I think it's the amount of value you place on something. Your brain will prioritize what to use its memory cells on. And I think a lot of people are frustrated that they just listen to, like Grant said, you listen to all these pop songs and those take up all, like, you memorize those even if you don't want to. You remember things. You
yeah.
You remember bad cartoon or like commercial jingles or cartoon shows you don't care about anymore, but you used to remember them because you're just around them all the time. And I think a key to it is the more you immerse yourself in the subject or whatever you're trying to memorize, the more you spend time on it and just immerse yourself in it in general, you'll have a way better chance of remembering it.
They list here, again, a few other helpful pastimes that can just improve brain function in general and also help your memory. They say if you work on learning a new language, that helps. Language lessons have been shown to provide a beneficial brain workout and increase neuronal connections. So that's quite a task, but yeah, that's a good one. They say meditating helps. While it may seem you're not doing much of anything in terms of challenging your brain when meditating, research shows it alters the structure of your brain for the better and has a number of neurological benefits, including improved attention and concentration. I don't know. They call it meditating. I guess it could be, I guess if you're thinking on something. I think sometimes that's thought of as just like zoning out and staring at the wall. But if you're deeply concentrating on something, that could be helpful. This is an interesting one. They say listen to Mozart. We probably have heard this before. They said it's long been theorized that listening to music may boost your brain power. And you probably heard of the Mozart effect, which suggests listening to classical music can help make you smarter. And indeed, research shows people who listen to Mozart's classical music have an increase in brainwave activity linked to memory, understanding, and problem solving. But what's interesting is that music composed by Beethoven showed no such effect. Poor Beethoven. Right? It's not all the same for some reason. There's something about Mozart's music that's different with the way our brain operates.
Yeah, well, Beethoven, I think he wrote most of all his compositions while he was deaf, so maybe that has something to do with it. It just, he couldn't use the same kind of patterns that Mozart could, that I have no idea.
Yeah, they say the results may, as far as the way the brain functions with Mozart, these results may be representative of the fact that Mozart's music is able to activate neuronal cortical circuits, which are circuits of nerve cells in the brain related to attentive and cognitive functions. So there is something about the pattern that he tapped into that works. And it's interesting when you think about some of that great music. You never hear of like the new Mozart, right? Oh, this guy's the next Mozart. Nobody apparently is in that range. I don't know. Maybe he broke the mold or something.
Right. Yeah. And of course, a couple hundred years ago, there weren't nearly as many musicians to come before him. So it's whenever you're one of the founding guys, it does help a lot as well to be remembered for a really long time.
This other one, this is supposed to help your brain function as well. And it ties into, you're talking about Grant using all the senses. They say sniff rosemary oil. Engaging your smelling senses may also have an effect on memory, they say. Smells get routed through your olfactory bulb, the smell analyzing region of your brain, which is closely connected to some other stuff. brain regions that handle memory and emotion. And people who sniffed rosemary essential oil perform better on memory tasks than those who did not. Peppermint has also been shown to enhance memory and increase alertness, which is interesting.
Sniffing it or eating it?
Just smelling it. Okay. Yeah, the aroma of it. You know, it is interesting. You've probably had this happen to you. It's happened to me. You smell something, and you think it takes you back to a certain time and place. You know, like a certain unique smell of some kind. Hopefully a good one. and yeah, you know, you think, oh, wow. Like, that's happened to me, and sometimes I can't even totally place it. But I know it's from a lot long ago, and I remembered it. So it is interesting the way that the even smell affects the brain.
Yeah, that does just prove that that is a really good way of trying to get your memory in line if you're trying to remember something. And that's what I must have been looking for all these years when I've been memorizing things. I was trying to incorporate smell, and now the only one I'm missing is taste, apparently.
Yeah, they don't have anything in here about taste, but this is the last one. They say laugh it up. Laughter has been shown to improve memory by reducing levels of the stress hormone cortisol, as explained by this author talking about it here. And so having a little bit of a chuckle, relaxing, that can help you memorize stuff too. So
actually, I've incorporated taste into my memory bank in an unfortunate way. Just that when I write, I usually eat No, it depends, but usually the more words, the more calories I intake. So it's a big sacrifice in a sense. But sometimes, depending how the length of what I'm writing, I'll eat like a snack or be drinking water, tea, whatever it is, and I'll drink so much of it or eat so much of it that whenever I eat it, I remember like, oh, that's I was working on this last time I was eating this. And I remember the article and like what I was researching, and I can even remember quotes from that what I was researching at the time just from eating something.
So eating and drinking is like your creative trigger. It's like you associate snacking with creative writing, and then it kind of actually helps you produce it more.
Yeah, I found a good use for junk food, I suppose.
Wow. So. Just so listeners know, when Abraham's not talking, he's eating an entire roast beef sandwich here in the studio.
Arby's?
Yeah.
Our endorsement?
Just kidding. He's not eating at this particular juncture. So those are some interesting things about how to improve memory and brain function, and we all want to do that. Yeah, like you say, it's always easy to remember things you don't want to remember. You know, like the song lyric you wish you could forget or whatever. Yeah. But the things you want to remember sometimes is harder. This is the month of March is, of course, March Madness and college basketball. And people really enjoy that. I like watching that, too. This is kind of an interesting list I thought the listeners might enjoy. Here are some of the strangest NCAA traditions. Schools have different traditions when it comes to athletic events. At the University of New Hampshire, fish throwing is one of their traditions. A man named Travis Sawyer, appropriately dubbed the Fish Man, attends many hockey games at the Whitmore Center in the same section. After the home team's first goal, he throws a fish onto the rink, and then he goes down and cleans it up.
Oh, he has to do it himself.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But they expect it, so they just wait for it. He scores a goal, he throws a fish out there.
How long does that take? It seems like that would be a substantial delay of game.
I don't know. It is a strange thing, but it's part of the culture now up there at University of New Hampshire.
Huh. Well, because I'm a Detroit Red Wings fan, and they throw the octopus on the ice during home games, and I understand why they do that, because the Joe Louis Arena is right next to a seafood place in Detroit, and at the time when they started doing that, there were 8 games you had to win to get to the Stanley Cup, and there
were eight legs
on an octopus, so that kind of makes sense a little bit. But with this, I guess each kind of hometown has their own little tradition or something that's unique, and I think different places throw different things. Like in Florida, they throw rats on the ice because they're not live rats, but like plastic ones. Because during their big playoff run in the 90s, one's player's nickname was something about like the rats or like a rat or something. I forget exactly, but they throw plastic rats on the ice when
that's
they're
great.
In the playoffs for some reason.
Interesting. Here's another strange NCAA tradition. In Arkansas, they do the calling of the hogs. They actually call hogs to come running. I guess that's they said it didn't need an explanation. I would like a little bit of an explanation, but that is what it is. They're the Razorbacks. At Taylor University, I like this one. They do Silent Night. During the small college's first home basketball game every year, the crowd remains completely silent from the opening tip till the home team's first point. Then fans erupt in cheers, sometimes storming the court and celebrating aggressively for several minutes.
What? Where is that again?
That's at Taylor University. It's a small school. I'm not sure exactly where it's located.
Wow. That's fantastic.
I think that's a kind of a neat idea. Wake Forest, they TP the quad. Every time Wake Forest team wins big games, fans cover the beautiful campus in toilet paper. Well, of course they do.
That's not fantastic. That's destructive.
That's destructive. That doesn't help anybody. University of Pennsylvania, they do tossing the toast. Once a football game reaches its third quarter, Penn students sing the charming song, Drink a Highball. After the line, here's a toast to dear old Penn, they throw toast on the field, and then a toast Zamboni picks it up. They drive like an ice machine, but they drive it around and they pick up the toast.
So they serve tomorrow in the cafeteria.
maybe so. Well, they always talk about how college students always struggle to make ends meet, and here they're throwing toast and toilet paper around. Save yourself some bucks. Don't do it.
Yeah, it seems like they have no excuse in that case.
This one's from the Florida State University, Sod Cemetery. If you should dare to lose to FSU in a game, their fans will literally steal the grass off your field. They pluck sod from the enemy's territory after away game victories and plant it in a cemetery back home. So if they beat you, they're going to take part of your field home and plant it.
Is that legal? Or
doesn't seem like it should be. Just little pieces. I don't think they're taking all of it, but still.
From the field or the sideline? That would be interesting to find out.
I don't know how they get it. That's interesting. And finally, this is John Brown University, the toilet paper game. At the first men's basketball home game of the year, fans come armed with rolls of toilet paper. Once the team scores, they hurl the rolls onto the court, and every single year they get a technical foul for it. Just keep doing it. And they know it's coming. First home game of the year, score the point. There goes all the stuff on the court, technical foul.
Oh, right after the first points.
Yeah,
oh,
okay. First point. Okay. They just, everybody throws it on the court, technical foul, got to clean it up. That's a tradition at John Brown University. So different universities just have some bizarre things they do. But, you know, if you're there and you're one of the students, you probably really relish the doing those types of things.
It sounds like a lot of these schools do not think highly of their custodians who have to clean these things up.
That's what I was thinking. They, you know, they've got to be ready for it every year too. Like, oh, tonight's the, you know, the toilet paper game, so got to be ready.
It's exciting for everyone else except for those one or two people.
I was just thinking about how wasteful that is. It's expensive to buy all that stuff.
Well, and a lot of trees sacrifice themselves for the sake of those traditions as well.
What do they do? Do they just throw it away afterwards?
Well, hopefully, if it's still in the package, you could just put it in part of the school's stockpile.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That, it would be nice if they kept it in the package, but I'm guessing they don't.
Yeah.
So those are some of the interesting traditions different universities have. There's a lot more than that. Those are just a few of them. I think at UCLA they kick a flagpole or something. It's a strange stuff that they do, but part of the history of some of those schools. You're listening to Trumper Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, go ahead and do that at KPCGFM. Also, you can send us emails to comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate those. Grant, you've got an interesting write-up here. This ties in with, the Trumpet Daily program from the last 2 days. They were talking about the aftermath there in London. And this is a write-up from the New York Times. It says, London Pride Undaunted. And I guess they're kind of, they think it's a positive thing that London's sort of carrying on. But that would be questionable, I think.
Right. It seems like the Trumpet and our radio programs have been vastly different from the media elsewhere, because it's almost like everyone else seems to be praising the way that Londoners move on as if nothing happened. And here we are saying that there needs to be a decisive response to something like this, or else are terrorists really going to admire the fact that people in London are not doing anything at all? Is that really going to deter them from doing it again in the future? This article even brings out that everyone there knows it's not the last time it will happen. Well, there are ways to make sure it's the last time, and yet no one's willing to take drastic action about it.
Now, I don't totally know the answer to this. You guys might be able to help me out. It's a famous term, keep calm, carry on. That's from World War II.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah, because of obviously they were being bombed and they were in the middle of a terrible war, and they had to. And I think that the intent of that saying is stay focused, but they're still fighting. Carry on in terms of we're fighting this war.
Right.
And now it's kind of being brought out like, well, let's just ignore the battle that we're in. And so they've kind of twisted even the meaning of that phrase, it seems.
Well, yeah. Now our people and those over in Britain are pretending like we're not in a war when clearly the other side believes in every sense that we are in a war. So who's right? Usually the side that thinks we're at war is going to be a lot more serious and is going to really cause a lot more destruction than the other side.
It was brought out on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with Stephen Fleury, where he had an example of where there were some people in London or close by, where there was a group of people, and I think they were Islamic, and they were chanting death to America or death to Britain or something. And you know, in shops where people were doing their day-to-day business, and some people mentioned it to the officers that were around, like, hey, and they say, well, it's their freedom, it's their right, as if the enemy is in your midst calling for your death and you just have to sit there and ignore it.
Yeah, and there's really an astounding paradox to that, because people's natural response is to say, well, then get out if you really want to destroy the country where you're living. And yet the term get out sparks more outrage than saying death to America or death to Britain.
That's a lot of what you're hearing are articles like this from the New York Times saying, just carry on, no big deal. And it's been brought out on, like, again, like I said, on the Trumpet Daily Radio shows, that's completely the wrong way to go about it. It's just abject surrender.
Right. We had a Key of David program play on this station, a rerun a few days ago. And in it, Mr. Gerald Fleury was talking about how Theodore Roosevelt believed in speaking softly but carrying a big stick. The whole world knew that if you challenged America in any way, like a terrorist attack like that, that they would pay dearly for it. And sure enough, he never had a war during his entire presidency. That is how you respond. History shows us exactly how to prevent future attacks like that.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I guess, with this right up here from the New York Times, they're praising London for just having the pride, like they say, and ignoring it and just carrying on. I think from what I read of the article, they were, you know, saying, hey, everything's back to normal. You know, we can have a terror attack. Okay, everything's back to normal. And but eventually, if it gets bad enough, there is no going back to normal. Right. And what does normal even mean? Is the new normal living with the threat of terror every day? It's a terrible normal.
Right. And this author and many others have praised just that, going on like it's normal. This author even went so far as to praise a taxi cab driver he heard in the street complaining that there was still a traffic slowdown because of the aftermath of the terrorist attack. So clearly, he just was thinking about his job and trying to pick people up and didn't care that four people had died, and then the attacker also died from that. So is that really something to praise? I mean, obviously, people are inconvenienced in their everyday lives by a terrorist attack, but is that really something to point out specifically and praise about a certain society, that they don't even care about their fellow Britons dying?
Yeah, that seems like it's a pretty self-absorbed viewpoint, you know, to where, it didn't affect me, so get out of my way. Instead of looking at the bigger problem in the country, which does affect everybody there or here in America or wherever these attacks occur, because, you know, them yesterday, but it could be you tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So it could be anybody.
Well, and here's the other thing. This article, once again, it took a drastic turn, even like the one we were talking about yesterday. And it immediately found a gratuitous moment to attack the Trumps, because apparently Mr. Trump's son said, this is what happens when you allow unvetted refugees into the country, things like that. And maybe that's not specifically accurate in this case, but when people are trying to speak out and warn of, you know, attacks or danger to a country, that's not political opportunism. That is just like Winston Churchill did with that same country where this attack took place. He wasn't being an opportunist. In fact, the last thing he wanted was to go into a world war, I'm sure. But when that's the only option, you have to acknowledge reality and face it.
It does make you wonder, and probably the enemies of Britain and the U.S. are thinking the same thing. What does it take to provoke a response? You know, how far can you push it? I mean, how big does the attack have to be for there to be any sort of response? Because we've seen quite a few attacks. You know, we're going to talk later about how many we've seen over there in London and that area. We've had a bunch in the U.S. Of course, after 9/11, we had a response to it. Since then, I don't know that we've had much. Maybe drones, I guess, going after some terrorists and things like that. There have been a little bit of a response, but not enough to actually stop the problem.
No sort of response that would strike fear into the heart of the enemy, which is exactly what you need. If, sure, we responded in a certain way, and maybe one person out of many thousands in a gigantic terrorist army died, well, that's not going to strike fear into their hearts. That, especially when the ideology is dying for what they believe in, that's not going to really scare too many people. They still believe they have a great chance of winning when something like that happens with an isolated drone strike.
We've seen this sort of, well, just let's move on and forget about it, even happen in the media. Probably kind of has to, because it used to be when you'd have a terrorist attack, that would be in the headlines for a week, 2 weeks. It'd be the one-year anniversary, the look back, all this. There's so many. There have been so many that you can't really do that. Mm-hmm. Like when this one happened, like this was the one-year anniversary in London. There was a one-year anniversary of the one in Brussels, right? Happened on the same day?
Yeah.
Right.
And so, like, that came out in the news, and, you know, I was like, oh, that's right, you know what I mean? But there's been so many that it's hard to keep it all in your mind as to what's occurred, and so I think it's just wearing people down.
Yeah, that's shocking that Brussels attack was already a whole year ago. I remember it like it was yesterday almost. This whole year has flown by, and obviously we've had dozens more attacks to think about since that one happened last year. These attacks are just only picking up the pace. So why are we responding to them the exact way with a calm resolve, going about our day as if nothing happened, never taking time for self-reflection? This author even goes so far as to say he's never been so proud of his country's diversity since the 2012 opening ceremony for the Olympics over there. So he's talking about a country's diversity when some of the people that make you diverse just killed some of your people. That really just shows how detached from reality most of the mainstream media is, but also a lot of people who maybe don't care enough because it wasn't their own friends or family members who were killed.
Yeah, it reminds me sort of like this overall mentality of just, well, let's ignore it. It reminds me of, like, say, a parent in a grocery store, you know, when the kid's melting down because they didn't get something and they're just throwing a fit. And sometimes you'll see the parents just try to take the high road, I guess. And, well, I'm not going to pay attention to that. I'm going to ignore that. And, well, what happens? Well, years down the road, or maybe not so many years down the road, that kid will probably destroy your home.
Right.
In some fashion. Now, maybe not, you know, in a way that would be this outrageous. But there's going to be problems there because you're not dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
You can sit there and ignore problems all day and act like, well, I'm not even going to respond to that. But it doesn't solve the problems. And it forces you to either at some point respond or realize at some point, oh, wow, I surrendered and it's too late. There's nothing I can do anymore.
Right. Sometimes it just seems to take a really long time for, especially people in the West with liberal ideals and thinking that all nations are the same and at their core want to get along. It seems to really take a long time for people like that to realize there's a threat and react to it. And here's a situation where how do the enemies respond when we don't respond? They say, well, thank you for not responding. We're actually grateful to you for that, and we're going to continue doing what we're doing because there's no pushback at all.
Yeah, I don't know if the idea is that, well, if we just ignore it, it'll go away. When does that ever work with any problem? You know, never. You can't just ignore things into non-existence that I know of.
Yeah, well, I think with the Pride of London, I mean, they do have a lot to be proud of. I mean, they've been through some pretty amazing catastrophes. But I think they forget why those catastrophes happened in the first place. Why did Nazi Germany bomb London? Because of years of moral corruption and moral weakness of the government not responding to the threat when they could have and prevented it from even happening. So although there is a lot of threat and they've been through a lot worse in that city, the whole reason it happened in the first place is because the government had the same reaction as what they're doing now, and that's not destroying the source of the threat. At this, with ISIS, is you have to go into the Middle East and defeat, cut off the head from the snake, and that's ISIS, and then also ultimately Iran. If you don't do that, there will always be terrorist attacks, and it's going to keep getting worse and worse until you might have to fight a world war to stop it. I mean, that's just the way it goes.
And you talk about moral corruption in the government. The only way that's possible is if the people are morally corrupt and allow those people to be in power over them. So really that does get back to every single person being impacted or responsible for things like this in some way. And that's why self-reflection is needed.
Yeah, there's a lot of good write-ups about all of those topics at thetrumpet.com that give you some great insight into the cause of terrorism and the corruption we see in different countries and so forth. So make sure you stop and look at thetrumpet.com for those write-ups. That's a great article to look at, not necessarily because it's true, but from the New York Times, but because it shows the spirit of the age. London Pride Undaunted. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm, and we have a live link there at thetrumpet.com as well. Abraham, we might as well get into your history portion because it ties directly into that article. Some of the history of terror incidents in London, there's been more than one. So it's good to look at some of the history of that and remember what's occurred there.
Yeah, it's actually just researching this. It's amazing how many terrorist attacks there have been in that city. And this is just going up until after World War II. And there's literally been hundreds of terrorist attacks in London. A majority of them were during the committed by the IRA and other Irish groups against the British government during the Troubles and during the war with Ireland that we talked about earlier this week. That's the main source of the terrorist attacks. They're not done by Islamic perpetrators, but actually most of them are done by people within the United Kingdom fighting for some kind of right, and they'll commit a terrorist attack. So since World War II, basically during the 1970s, that's when it really ramped up, and there were tons of, from even Scottish nationalists, they would send Margaret Thatcher a bomb in the mail.
Wow.
And it was intercepted. Lots of bombings of embassies, assassinations of political leaders in London, from different embassies, depending on what country was trying to send a message to that, the country of who was assassinated. So lots going on, but the main ones I want to focus on were in the 1970s, we also saw a rise of terrorism from the Palestinians. So as the Palestinians were struggling to get any kind of recognition from the world, they did commit some kind of terrorist attacks in London. There were also some from South Africa, because of, as the British Empire fell apart, you had these different freedom fighters commit terrorist attacks against the British government to send a message, or vice versa. You would have even loyal people to Britain commit an attack against a diplomat of that breakaway country in London. But let's just talk about terrorist attacks from Islamic terrorists, because those are the most relevant to the attacks we just saw this week. So in 1969, there was a Palestinian exploded a bomb outside of a department store. In 1971, the Jordanian ambassador to London was wounded when shots were fired by some Palestinian terrorists as well. Then you also had some other basically assassination attempts on Israeli ambassadors, or just different people involved with Israel, because the Palestinians were trying to make a political point. Then you also had the most famous one in the history of London is probably in the 30th of April, the 5th of May, 1980, and that was the Iranian embassy siege. And that's when six armed men stormed the Iranian embassy in London. They took 26 people hostage. They did execute one person there, and it ended with, after 6 days, when the SAS stormed in and killed all the terrorists, or they arrested them. So that's the most famous one. There's tons of footage online of it going on. Very dramatic event,
mm-hmm.
With Iranian nationals trying to make a point about what the regime change in Iran.
Yeah, so interesting when terror attacks actually occur, they always end the same way. They don't end until you kill the perpetrator.
Yeah.
There's never unless you captured them, I suppose, and, you know, took them to prison or something. But for the most part, it ends with people getting killed. That's what happened. You know, you have to kill the person doing it, sadly, but that's because it's just so out of control. And it's funny how it just festers and festers and festers until it gets to that one point. And then when it's absolutely forced, then you have to use the ultimate, I guess, power in that sense to stop it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a great point, that there's never been a terrorist who surrendered peacefully, because at that point especially if it's an ideology that worships death is the ultimate glory. And mm-hmm. So why would you settle for something less than that? In that kind of ideology.
Yeah, there's even instances that I've read about where people were trying to commit terror attacks and got caught before they did it, and they wanted to be killed because that was their goal. They asked to be shot because that was the end goal. And so you're not going to talk to somebody in that mindset, in that mind frame, and convince them to change their ways.
Yeah, you can't negotiate with someone who's already died, essentially, in their own mind. Like, they're already dead. They're just about to try to kill more people with them. So 1980 is kind of when everything changed, when with the Iranian embassy siege that kind of started everything off. In the 21st century, in 2005, there were the July 7th bombings, and that's when there were four bombs went off on the subway. There were 52 people were killed and over 700 injuries.
Yeah,
that's probably the most deadly terrorist attack in recent memory. And then later, just 2 weeks later, there was attempted bombings. Four more bombs were supposed to go off by suicide bombers, but they failed to detonate. So that's one that a lot of people remember. And that kind of changed how Britain approached terrorism, because it actually happened. 2007, there were two unexploded car bombs. They were able to find them and stop them from exploding, but it wasn't an attempt. 2013, this one, it was very dramatic all over the news. The murder of Lee Rigby. That was that British soldier who was beheaded on a street there in London, right beside the Royal Artillery Barracks, committed by two men. They videotaped it, and that was all over the place.
Yep.
2015, December of 2015, a man with a knife stabbed a number of people at the Leytonstone tube station, shouting, "This is for Syria." So some kind of terrorist attack there revolving around the Syrian civil war. And then October 2016, police conducted a controlled explosion of an IED that was found in North Greenwich. There were no injuries, but someone did plant a bomb there, try to kill some people. And then, of course, the one that happened this week, that's the latest one. So long history.
Yeah, a really long history. But what it reveals is that, go back to 1980, we all know where the terrorism's coming from. You know, it might have different branches, but it's all coming from that Iranian radical government.
Yeah.
And again, there's lots of different branches and different, and they fight amongst themselves. And there's a lot there to unpack, I suppose. But that's where it's coming from now. There's always been terrorism; people do things like that over the years. But boy, you look at that regime change in Iran, and then you see all of these attacks, and they're mostly coming from Islamic nations.
Yeah, so. It's really interesting. Before 1980, they were pretty much all by Scottish and Irish terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
After 1980, a lot of them are from Islamic terrorists. So you can see where it wasn't just regime change inside of Iran. It was a global network of terrorism that was established, meant to export that kind of tactic against the West. They're not just wanting to destroy Israel. They want to destroy us. And Iran will fund any group, doesn't matter if they're Sunni or Shiite, to destroy us.
Yeah, so and people find themselves in this really strange spot where they know where it's coming from, but yet don't want to offend, you know, a religion, or don't want to offend a group of people, and so that's where they sit, and then it just keeps happening. So it's just a really interesting spot to be in.
Yeah, once you commit to multiculturalism, you have to be willing to give up some of your security for the sake of rights, because people can bring in ideas that clash with your own, but you have to be willing to live with that. But I think what we're seeing now, just in the past 10 years, is the tipping point to where it's not just people coming here to live, you have people coming here to conquer.
Yeah.
That's the big difference. And we're starting to see the weakness of that system, and of that multicultural type ideal, where we think everyone can live together in peace. It's never going to be that way, as long as nations like Iran and ideologies like extreme Islam exists, because there is no compromise in that way of life. It's only conquest.
Yeah, really, really, really interesting. Really highlights the weakness of the West to not want to call out, confront the enemy, and then deal with the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but interesting history to go through. You've got one of the write-up for us. This is a technology one. And I saw this one last night, too, and I didn't read much about it, so I'm very interested in this. But as a German scientist, right?
Yes.
This is from The Telegraph. World's largest artificial sun shines brightly for the first time. What's the point of this? what are they going to do with this thing?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. When I first read the headline, I'm like, wow, they actually made like a miniature sun, and that's not the case.
The first thing I thought of was, and it's totally unrelated, but it was the Death Star from Star Wars. I'm like, I just thought of like an artificial planet. I'm like, the Death Star, but completely different.
Yeah, to the disappointment of many, it wasn't the Death Star. But basically what they're doing is they wanted to create an artificial source of solar radiation in order to test different kinds of fuels renewable resources. So this artificial sun, it's massive. When you look at pictures, it looks like a huge crystal ball because of all these different huge lamps on it. Each lamp is at least 3 feet wide and huge light bulbs. There's 149 powerful short arc lamps. They're all put together into one. And so when you turn it on, it can produce, it's called Synlight, S-Y-N, so it's like synthetic light. Synlight can produce light which is 10,000 times the intensity of the solar radiation at the Earth's surface. So when sunlight hits the Earth, it creates solar radiation. We can use that like for heating things, for powering solar-powered electricity, all that kind of thing. So this artificial sun can create 10,000 times that intensity. And even the lamps can reach a temperature of 3,000 degrees Celsius.
Cool.
And the whole point of it is by having more intense solar radiation, or like heat, and basically, you can you can create better fuels using hydrogen, because hydrogen doesn't produce carbon dioxide when it burns. It produces water. So they think that's the fuel of the future. So it doesn't produce carbon dioxide and increase global warming, all that.
The 3,000 Celsius lamp not producing global warming.
Yeah, exactly. So they want to use that intensity of the solar radiation to test the hydrogen to make some kind of fuel that in the future can replace carbon fuels. That's basically the whole goal of this project.
Wow. That's it's got to be quite the facility that it's in.
Yeah.
Because it has to handle the temperature, must take a tremendous amount of power to fuel that electricity or whatever they're using.
Yep.
And you need to be shielded from its output. So they must have really built a special facility to keep it from just radiating everybody.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I didn't see anything about the facility. I assume it might be underground or something like that. Yeah, they're really excited about it because this is the kind of thing they're moving towards to produce the fuels of the future. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it does have some merit to it, I think, especially this kind of technology is not affected by weather. You can always get that output of solar radiation from these lamps, so you can produce some kind of fuel from it. The problem is it takes fuel to fuel it.
Right.
So what kind of fuel is that? It doesn't say.
Oil.
Yeah.
No,
it's probably some kind of carbon fuels fueling the artificial sun. So they're using it to research these hydrogen fuels that they can use, and maybe they can make some breakthroughs that could make it more viable for like a large scale economy. So that's the idea with this artificial sun. Overall, its practicality is mainly for research. It won't produce electricity for Germany or anything like that, or for the local area. But it's an interesting idea, and we might see a lot more of these pop up around the world.
Well, they're known to be pretty good scientists in general, I think. So anytime you see them doing something, it's usually pretty well thought out. There might be something to it. I guess ultimately you would want to create some sort of like energy loop where it builds off of itself, and then it's sustainable and you don't run out of it. Once you get it going, you know, it keeps going type of thing. But you know, it'd be great to see them come up with something that was better.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of not causing pollution and that type of thing. But you always have to be a little bit skeptical when you see this. One, that it would work, but two, is it going to be weaponized? You know, I mean, every time there's technology breakthroughs, it seems like it ends up going towards some sort of armaments.
Right. Well, I think the best technology we have for producing clean energy is nuclear technology. Right now we use the decay of an atom to produce energy instead of the fusion of atoms together. That's cold fusion, what it's called, and that's a lot of people moving towards because there's no radioactive output from it. So it's completely clean and it produces more energy, they think, but we don't know how to do it yet. So that, right now, that's probably the best idea we can have, but we don't know how to do it yet. We're not there technologically. So things like this, they could be used in lots of ways to produce different things or create hydrogen fuel that can be used for war, like aircraft, tanks, that kind of thing. It doesn't produce smoke that you can see from a distance, so or any kind of indication that way. So they could be weaponized somehow, but I think what they're going to find out is that going this way is pretty futile, and that using nuclear technology is probably the best way to go. But at the same time, the more nuclear breakthroughs we use, the bigger bombs we can produce, and it's just a pretty vicious cycle.
Yeah, and then, of course, potential meltdowns and things like we've seen, even over there in Japan, I guess.
Fukushima.
Yeah, they have radioactive hogs running around, which is an interesting write-up if you get a chance to read that. The people can't go back into the village because there's radioactive hogs, which wild hogs are dangerous anyway, and they're radioactive. I don't think that means much other than you don't want to be near them because it's not like they have superpowers as far as I can tell, but they're pretty vicious. And so anyway, they're going around trying to get rid of those. So anytime they do something that has some positive effects, it seems like there's always the negative side, and that's always the paradox.
Yeah, that's, I think what's interesting is mankind on our own, we've produced come across amazing discoveries about how science and everything works, but without extra help, we've reached a wall that we can't break through.
Yeah, and that paradox is talked about in Mystery of the Ages, which is a book offered on the Key of David program this week. It's a new program going through those chapters of Mystery of the Ages. Make sure you check that out. Also, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Trumpet Hour Week in Review program as well, and all the other programming this weekend here on KPCG. That's all the time that we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. Myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turchin, Abraham Blondo, have a great, great weekend. Really enjoy it. And we'll talk to you again on Monday.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.
Live streaming at kpcg.fm. Trumpet.